Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for attending the Boston Book Festival. My name's Jeannie Blasberg, and I serve as co-chair of the board of the Boston Book Festival. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon to Art, War, and Adventure. I support the Boston Book Festival because I absolutely love these amazing author events, and I want to make sure they continue on into the future, free to the public. And to do that, we rely on donations large and small. So if you find yourself really enjoying your day today, I encourage you to go online and make any size donation. It really makes a difference. And if you swing by our membership tent, you might even get some free swag, or not free because you've become a member, but you'll get some swag as a thank you. Wow. Let's see. Most important. After this session, the authors' books will all be sold right out here in the lobby. So please buy lots of books, and then you can have the authors sign them, and the line will form, and the signing will be in the next room. So with no more ado, I'd like to introduce the moderator for today's session, Robin Call.
Thank you. What is in the goodie bag if you sign up?
I think maybe some books or some bookmarks.
I think it's nice to know.
Before I hand it over to Robin, one of our authors, Emily Franklin, is celebrating a birthday today. So happy birthday.
Thank you.
And thank you for spending it at the Boston Book Festival.
Thank you.
What are you going to do next year?
Probably the same thing.
Oh, I thought you were going to introduce all the authors. That's okay.
I'm sorry, Robin. I was assuming. But I'm happy to. I'm honored to.
That's what I was told.
Sitting to Robin's left is Emily Franklin and Steve Kiernan and Henriette Lazaridis.
Lazaridis. I'm sorry. That's what they told me I was going to be done. But they have amazing bios, all of them. I can't do them off the top of my head. But I know Emily, Stephen, and Henriette, and I am thrilled to be here in Boston on what turned out not to be a rainy day. And thank you so much. And we squeezed a little closer because there's nothing like the closeness of authors and books and community. And as we all know, it's been a week. I was saying to Stephen, I was at Morristown Book Festival last week, and when we were doing our panels, we were blissfully ignorant of what was going on until we weren't. And so I just want to start off by not saying anything really more than that, except for recognizing for everybody, it's been, our hearts and minds are here and there, and also checking in with the three of you about how your week was, how books and arts are sustaining, or how do you toggle on a week like this?
Well, I think that, as you have suggested, that books and literature are soul-saving, and my literary community and my Jewish community have all come together for that, which is a lovely thing in a time that is really scary and really awful.
Yeah. And it feels good to be with like-minded and, thoughtful people, which, what's better than the Boston Book Festival? So, yeah.
You know, there was a piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago. It was called, "I Hope Someone Is Looking After My Son."
Oh, that was...
And, this woman wrote about... and I'm a very doting dad. My sons are grown men and all, but I'm still a doting dad. And her son was there, and... In the first attacks, I think he may have been at the rock concert, and what she knew from video clips that she had seen was that one of his arms had been blown off, mm-hmm. but that he was still alive and that he was carried away, and she made this plea for peace and for her son, and I thought, first of all, this is one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever read, and this woman probably now is a week without sleep worrying about her son and that sort of thing, but also that she had the capacity to sit down and write it and break all of our hearts, right? Hundreds of thousands of hearts broken by this thing that she wrote. And I think that's part of what we do, is tell the individual tale that signifies kind of a larger story that many people can relate to. And so for me, she's the first hero that I have of this ugly thing that's going on, that she had that capacity of heart and talent and craft.
Thank you. Mm. Thanks, Stephen. Yeah.
Using the written word to arouse empathy in others, which is why one of the main things that we do when we create literature and when we read literature, that's what it can do for us, is allow us to see from someone else's point of view. I actually couldn't finish that piece, because sometimes what you learn is more than you want to bear at that particular moment, but it's important all the same.
Yeah. Well, thank you, because it's hard, and we're here to celebrate books, and it's also important, so it's like sort of tricky, and I knew that the three of you would be on that same page. And these books have all come out various times this year, winter, spring. Please silence all phones. Thank you. But not everybody's read all of them, so I always like to start off with a little bit of, if somebody runs into you and says, Emily, Stephen, Henriette, what are your books about? Like, what is it that you share?
Well, I think we do all share focus on art.
Oh, no, I meant, like, what do you tell them? What's your 3-minute pitch?
What do we share?
What do you, sorry, share?
Your elevator pitch.
I've never been accused of not being literal, which is weird for a novelist, but true. Well, my novel, Terra Nova, is about a fictional exploration or expedition to be first to the South Pole in 1910. So it's about two explorers who are doing that and the woman they've left behind in London, who is in love with both of them, married to one, the lover of the other. And so it has issues, it raises issues about physical struggle, political struggle. The woman who's left behind is a photographer who's involved in photographing the suffrage movement, which is at one of its peaks in London at the time. So about the power of art and about artistic rivalry and exploration and independence. And it's very cold.
It looks, I mean, the cover is so engaging. The cover looks like
ice on the back. You know?
I love that.
Yeah.
It will melt in your hands.
No, you go.
Okay, so this one, let's start with an act of, what this book is about, let's start with an act of imagination. Let's say that it's a damaged country, and the people are polarized. They're very divided, and they're polarized financially and politically and religiously and culturally. And not only are they really fixed in their ways, but also they think the other people are corrupt and wrong. There's even a former president who's having rallies about a current president. Now, I know this is a very difficult thing to imagine, but it happened. It happened right after World War II in France. And the important thing, so this story in some ways is allegorical of now. The thing about setting it in France is it means the food is much better. It tells the story of a group of men, all of them very divided, all of them very damaged by the war, emotionally, psychologically, not so much physically, but they're all damaged goods. And they come, they all wind up at this chateau that's been making stained glass windows for over 400 years. And although they are of different faiths and all different countries, all kinds of backgrounds, they begin working together to build stained glass windows to replace the ones that were blown out by bombs during the war. And lo and behold, they find that when they begin to work on windows together, they have less time to fight each other. And they begin to create something together. They begin to heal a little bit. And they do some big things I'm not going to tell you, but that maybe have some can be analogous to where we are now. So that's Glass Chateau.
Thank you.
All right. The Lioness of Boston is historic fiction based on the life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. I think many people here might have been to or heard of the museum here, but maybe less is known about the life that she lived. And she lived this incredibly rich, full, big life. She was a feminist before feminism, a celebrity before celebrity culture existed. And in the novel, we sort of follow Isabella's life and love and tragedies. Again, no spoilers. And then also follow the history of Boston at that time. So as Isabella is becoming the woman that we know her to be now, Boston is becoming the city that we know it to be now. And so it is one part Gilded Age and one part sort of feminism and one part history.
All must reads, and thank you, Emily. I love, this is entitled Art, War, and Adventure, and whoever had the brilliance to put these three books, three authors, stories together, I was like, because I do a lot of panels, and sometimes I'm like, okay, like, how does this fit, or what's going on? I'm like, so I was like, this is so, just is so meant to be, and I'm so glad to be with us, like, now and for this time and with these books. And thinking about what inspired them for all of you, I mean, I know a lot, so I'm going to ask the obvious questions, but what was it, the people that you studied, obviously, in your case, Isabella, but yours, Henriette, and also Stephen with Marc Chagall and with the Explorer, like, can you talk about the people behind these stories?
I'll start to say, for me, the one person who really made Terra Nova the book I had to write, that was sort of 40 or 50 years in the making in my mind, was Robert Falcon Scott, who raced Amundsen, Roald Amundsen, in real life to be the first to the South Pole, and he was second. Scott was second to the South Pole. And it always interested me that when he got there second, like, what was that like to go all that way and see the Norwegian flag? You've yeah. suffered, you've starved, it's been freezing, and there's the flag. Are you kidding me right now?
Oh, well.
And, you know, and Scott's reaction was very noble. And I, especially as I grew older from hearing about Scott when I was a 7-year-old kid, I became interested in what would someone who wasn't like Scott do? What would a person do who didn't have a noble reaction and who had other characteristics, which I brought to bear in creating my character of Edward Haywood? And once I came up with the idea for the novel, I actually did the opposite of research. I stopped reading anything about Antarctica, any of the journals that I had on my shelves from Scott or anyone in his polar parties, because I didn't want to be influenced. I needed to make these very flawed men and flawed woman character, I needed to make them up out of whole cloth.
That's just amazing to have that in your head, that story, as a child. And like, what was that like to, you know, all right, so somebody planted the flag, but nobody wrote this book. So like, what was that like to be like, this is the perfect thing for me to do?
I don't know. For me, I mean, Beryl Bainbridge wrote this really amazing novel, The Birthday Boys,
right.
where each, she has, the narrative points of view are actual figures in Scott's polar party. And I think when I read it when I was in my 30s, I think when it came out, I was so excited for it. And it's a wonderful book, but it didn't do what I wanted to do.
Right. So you got to
and
do
so
that
I,
thing.
And so I felt like, okay, someday you have to write this book.
Yeah. I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys can just jump in. I'm not going to call on you, Stephen
okay,
or
so
Emily.
I needed my guys who were building windows to transform what a stained glass window could be. And I had that, and I knew that I needed that, that they needed to do something transcended. Everything that had been done before was stained glass windows. And when I came to that realization, I knew nothing about stained glass windows. And so I started looking around, and what I found was Marc Chagall. Now, do people know who Marc Chagall is? Okay, so, you know, I didn't know. But he's in our thinking. He's absolutely in our thinking. In the same way that I remember when I worked construction years ago, and a woman who's a friend of mine came by to see if I would have a beer with her after work, and we're all just grubby and that sort of thing, and after she left for the rest of the day, everyone called me Romeo. Now, I don't think that those people had read Shakespearean tragedy, but somehow, like, Shakespeare was in them, right? So here's how much Chagall is in it. If you don't know the guy's work, here's this. When he was 19 years old, he's absolutely broke. He's living in Moscow, and he's trying to make a living by painting the flats behind the Moscow Opera. And there's this opera that is lost to time. It was about the greatness of music, and he does a painting of somebody who's 4 times as tall as the building, and he's sort of dancing across the tops of all of the houses while he's playing his violin. And that's where the Fiddler on the Roof comes from. Like, he's in us even if we don't know his work. So he has clouds, cows flying through the air. This novel has cows flying through the air. He has a fish that presents a bouquet of flowers. There are many flower-bearing fish in this novel. Even though it's realism, there are ways that his genius and his kind of whimsy made it possible for me to do a much more imaginative book than I've written before. Right. I come from a newspaper background. My language tends to be pretty literal. This one required, like, turn on the violins and let it go. It also meant that I had to learn how to blow glass, and the word that the place that spent hours and hours and hours with me on this had a word for the kind of prodigy that I was, the immediate genius, and that word was pathetic. And it was amazing because they didn't have a conference about this. They would just walk by and see me just trying to make like a little globe, and they go, pathetic. You know, and like the guy who owns a place would look from his perch upstairs and go, that guy's pathetic. It was amazing. But I did learn how to carve glass flowers, and I made a bunch of those, and on the tour,
and I treasure giving, mine. Yeah,
yes, Robin has
I
one.
I do have one.
And I've given one out at every tour event, and that's been pretty fun. So I really did get into that, and the main thing that required, because some people, you know, are willing to suffer for their art, I did have to go over to France and spend some time immersed in Chagall
I know.
Thank you. I've tried to bear up.
Yeah. I went winter hiking and got really cold and frostbitten.
Well, I have to say,
I was going to ask you that. Did you go? Yeah.
I mean, I have winter hiked a little bit, but I've had frostbite.
You look hardy, though. You look like, I mean, the schlep from the library was enough for me already.
Yeah. Well, the cold in this novel is absolutely you want to put a blanket around you sometimes. It's very, very compelling and vivid and, anyway, so it was. It wasn't just that I did the homework about who is this guy Marc Chagall and his cool windows. It was this is a whole different kind of genius and a whole, a kind of imagination that is freer than mine. And that was I'm changed for life by that experience of just being inhabiting his work for 3 years.
Wow. Thank you. And Emily, I know that you have a connection to the museum. And
I do.
Had the pleasure of, it's like you're coming in the third act, but right. I can't help but share that, you know, there's such a personal connection to everybody up here, which is why I was so excited about this panel. But talk about how you suffered for Isabella's art.
I really didn't suffer. I mean, I grew up going to the museum. I grew up part in London and part here. But when I would go to the museum, and I was so completely captivated by that interior courtyard, and really the, I feel like Isabella Stewart Gardner was somebody who wanted to erase the boundaries between things, between places, like the inside and the outside, and between people. And so she was really friends. She dealt with a lot of personal rejection and personal tragedy and really was friendless until she began to befriend other people who were overlooked by society. So she was friends with lots of gay people and Jewish people, and really would probably have been called an early ally. But the people that are in here, the research that I had to do was pretty extensive, not only because the two people that she did sort of have as friends were her sisters-in-law, and everybody had children who were named either Joseph, John, or Jack. And it was very difficult to keep them all separate.
Yeah, I
made a third grade timeline where I could be like, that's when that person was born, and that's not the same person.
Oh,
they just are Jack called John, or John called Jack, or Joe called Jack. It was very confusing. But once I figured that all out, then I could really look into all the other stuff that was happening. Part of why this time period was so exciting was that Isabella, really, her natural curiosity for the world and for people was so exciting to look into. And she was friends with everybody. She was friends with John Singer Sargent and Henry James and Julia Ward Howe, who wrote Battle Hymn of the Republic. But she's also alive and experiencing, you know, the first Impressionist exhibit, where you've got, you know, Renoir and Monet and Manet and Cézanne and Pissarro and Bertha Morisot. And Bertha Morisot's in there because we don't know as much about her, and the reason we don't know as much about her is because she is the woman. She was the only female impressionist, and everybody forgets her. So I'm very interested in overlooked women in general. And, you know, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum itself is a perfect example of this, because we know the museum. If we know it, we know the museum, where we know that there were, very valuable works of art that were stolen from there. But we don't know much about her. And I believe that if we all thought of buildings that have male names, we know about those guys. And so why don't we know the women and the history that these women did? And so that's what I want. That was really the start of that. And then I was also there 10 days before the heist when I was a high school senior. Mm. And sort of wrote papers on two of the paintings that were stolen. And I was really captivated by the fact that those empty frames are still there. Mm. And really wanted to explore this woman whose psychology was such that she never wanted anything to be moved or changed, or Harvard gets everything. And they get the building, the contents, and the land underneath it if it's changed or moved. So, but she lived this incredible life, so that was
really amazing, too, that nobody's tried to, figure out a way around her words in some way to sort of... I mean, I'm glad that they have
it.
But,
Harvard needs that.
Right.
You know, people have sometimes very interesting ideas about what they need, and I know, I'm sure they probably do think that, but like you wonder.
Right, but her connection to Harvard was that she had sort of infiltrated this all-male Harvard world.
I love that.
Charles Eliot Norton, who was the first professor of art history at Harvard, was the person who really opened up her intellectual life, and how she started collecting was through him, and he's just done the first Dante translation with Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. So basically, like, everybody's alive at the same time. Wow.
You think about the companion books to all of these stories, and also, what are all of these notes? Are those all the Jack things?
No, so this is probably too much information for everybody, but I really like books to be like a living document. Mm. So when I have this is my I'm still on book tour, and I have all my notes in here, but I have lots of like speeches and different things. But when I am done, I will put it on the shelf like this.
Yep.
And that's actually, there is a scene where Isabella is beginning to collect rare books, and she puts the receipt, like the bill of sale, in it, because I do that. Or if my husband leaves me a little love note, or if my kid wrote a drawing, I put everything in the book that I'm reading at that time, and it goes on the shelf. And then it's like a living document, and somebody will find it, and when somebody has to go through my stuff, they'll see what was happening in my life at the time.
I love that. I mean, I love the way your books look, too, pristine. My books...
Actually, I want to jump in, I'm a little bit freaking out.
Do you feel like you need me to rip off a piece of paper for you to put in there?
Because when I was leaving my house in a hurry, I accidentally brought a fresh copy. And I normally have like all of that stuff in it, because if somebody says, will you read from it, I have a list of like five things to read and how long they are.
Is this your way of saying, can we be friends?
And can I just have your book for this event? Because it really is. And then there are these destroyed copies. And
Photograph it on Instagram. Everyone follows Stephen. No, you'll see that
One of the things is that when you've read something like 15 times, you find yourself reading to people like the 16th night of the Dory tour, and you're like, that word can go. When is the book finished? And you're like, never. And there's all this ink. Yeah, they're exactly.
But you have to do that.
You can make it better.
You edit. Well, but you have to do that when you're reading aloud, because certain words will trip you up, or there's certain references to things that the audience doesn't need to
know. That's so interesting.
And so you highlight and you make little notes, like, don't say that word, or they don't know who that is, or other things, or like you circle a word.
I love this.
That's why it's fun.
So glad I asked.
Yeah.
And what is your book
and
like?
Really,
notes in mine.
Yeah, like you're really, like Jack.
And
very
I have
civilized.
Marked up. I think in my first novel there was a section that I felt was always the right section to read, but not the way I'd written it. So I had all these things marked up. And here I know there's like a couple of phrases like, yeah, you're not reading those. And I just know.
Oh, that's
not even
so interesting.
But you're like my substitute mom. You're like, your book is very messy.
No, it was actually I loved it because my book. So I've been interviewing authors for 20 years. I started a radio show in 2002, and all of the authors that I would host on the radio show, and we've hosted live events, in-person events, my books are all filled with love like that. Yeah. And they are, it could have been the cocktail napkin at one of the events we did, or something somebody told me, or like something like that nobody knew. So like maybe if they find my books one day, whatever, all these little insider things. So I also love my books so much, and I'm not precious about them. And during COVID, when I was doing a million Instagram lives, I was like, I love my books so much, I like kissed one of them. Mm-hmm. And with my lipstick, I've forgotten like what people were like, oh my God, don't dog ear, don't whatever. And I'm like, they're my books. I'm moving in.
So, you know,
I mean, we're book people. We get it.
It's
so,
sort of like Velveteen Rabbit. If a book gets loved enough, it turns into a film deal.
Yes. I just thank you for all sharing that, because what do your books look like? Like, what is your process of like saving them and holding on to them and ever parting with them or any of that?
You mean the books that we read for
your own books? Yeah.
I actually, because I was an academic in my other life, I have, you know, most of my books have a lot of underlining, and I had this whole system for cross-referencing page numbers, and a lot of books have index cards in them where I have like the page number and then the theme or the topic or the question or the political or whatever commentary I needed. And so if you open up, especially the Penguin Classics, you open them up and there's all these index cards.
Oh, cool.
And I treasure those because you never know when someone's going to ask you to write another piece about, you know, Dickens's representation of colonialism in Bleak House.
You really don't know.
You just don't know that.
You're going to want those citations. And so I have them all on my shelves. I can't part with them. Those are very important. They're testaments to a moment of thought that was in my experience. And the trouble is that now, a book is a book, whatever format it comes in. And I have a lot of audiobooks that I listen to, and I do read both on Kindle and in hardcover. And this is the problem.
We're so inclusive.
I'm very inclusive because I have a spouse who needs to sleep. And if I'm there reading with a light on, he says it doesn't bother him, but I know that that's not nice. So that's when we bring the Kindle out. And that is the problem, is that you no longer, unless you go out and buy the book in hard copy, which I've also done, you lose the chance to have that memento, that milestone of this moment of thought in your life. And that our own books that we write are that as well. So I actually, this is a very weird thing to say, but I wonder sometimes, like, should I put my own books on the shelf alphabetically with all the other books, or should they be on their own shelf? Like, this is a thing I think about.
Yeah. I believe that. That makes perfect sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a whole system that is arcane, and sometimes it's folding down tops of pages, which is not as good as folding down bottom of page.
Yes.
And sometimes there'll be a group of pages together, but the big compliment is a paperclip. Because that means that I read something and either it was so good that it pissed me off, or I read it and I stopped, or made a mark to come back later and say, how did he or she do that? Mm. It was so good. And like, I don't read a lot of kind of horror, but I read the Passage trilogy by Justin Cronin. I don't know if any of you read that, but there's a part where it's kind of the end of the world, and it's 28 pages, and I've read it like 5, 6, 7 times now, just going, how did he do that?
Wow.
Because it's your goosebumps the whole way. It's an incredible ride, and man, paperclip on that, you know, just like sometimes somebody gets it so right. It's to me, it's like I just built a statue to them. It just cost less, and I can put it on the shelf.
And how do your books look, Emily?
My books, I have a lot of bookshelves, and then I also have those weird skyscraper towers of books on the floor and on various surfaces and other surfaces, and then I try to like get more surfaces to put books on.
Yep.
And then I have my to-be-read pile, which, you know, this time of year I try to like really start hoarding and making sure it's like a cozy pile so I don't feel like I need to go out and, you know, search for something.
Hunt.
I just have, I know what I'm going to be reading for each season. And they all have, you know, well-loved books have stuff in them. And then every once in a while, I have 4 kids and we're all readers and my husband, there's just a lot of books. And so every once in a while I have to cull the herd.
It's hard.
And donate. But it's really, those are books where, you know, I'm unlikely to read it again, or it didn't mean something. It was just, an enjoyable read. And then I can, you know, give it away or give it to friends.
It is always interesting, like, what you can part with and what you like to pass along and find new homes for, because I get so many and people ask me that, and I make sure they're all lovingly cared for in some manner. So the books have been out for a while. I'd love to hear what you've heard from some of your readers. Has anybody been inspired to go to the museum, to go to France, to go to, you know, lace up some boots and go to Antarctica, or, you know, or just readers' comments, thoughts, like what the books have meant to them?
Sure. I have a lot of people writing saying that they are going to the museum, some of them for the first time, which is really exciting, or organizing groups to go. A lot of the speaking engagements I've had, there have been sort of a field trip attached to that,
which is
really very sweet and exciting. Or people who have gone to the museum once or a handful of times, but then are going back with a different perspective because they understand her vision a bit more and her history and all of the people that... she collected, as well as the objects and art she collected, so that's very fun. And then other just nice, you know, it's just, I love getting emails and letters from people who, you know, a very sweet one who wasn't gonna write an email, and then her partner encouraged her to write an email, reaching out to see if I would, you know, come visit with her book group for 15 minutes, and she felt very so awkward writing to me, which is just very, I was sorry that she felt so awkward, but she said she felt a little bit braver having read the book. So,
oh, I like that.
I thought that was very nice.
You just never know which parts of the book are going to touch somebody at what time, or who's meant to read what, and how much and how far these books go, sharing them with each other, with friends, and also sharing back with the author, because you know, back in the day you had to actually really write a letter.
Yeah.
But you can email them. They're real people.
I know. But you would get these letters passed along from the publisher or your agent, and it was very fun.
I think mostly for me, and it cracks me up that people will say, and I think they mean it, but they'll say, I was so cold reading your book.
Yeah, you do get cold reading it.
But people say this. A lot of people say it. And I mean, I'm glad, because I get cold really easily. And I was definitely wearing like 3 sweaters and 2 pairs of sweatpants writing this thing, especially when I wrote the men's section. I started it in December of, I think, 2015. And I wrote it in the dark mornings all that winter. And it was not warm. Where, in my experience. And so people do say that, and I'm very pleased to hear them say that, because I have not yet been to Antarctica, and so I can't imagine, or I can only try to imagine, the kind of cold that these men experience. I would extrapolate from the cold that I've experienced, which is like, you know, I think the coldest I've been is like 20 below Fahrenheit. And you know, we're talking much more for what my male characters experience there. So, but that is what I hear from people.
Would you like to go? Is that a...
I was supposed to go 2 years ago. I finally decided that my lifelong dream, I couldn't put it off. My children... This has been something I've grown up with. I've grown up with, my children have grown up with, this desire to go to Antarctica before it was a place that anyone ever went, unless you were a scientist. And my children would say, Mom, you can't go to Antarctica. You'll get cold and you'll die. Like, with this sort of teenage deadpan delivery, like, because they knew I got cold really easily. But I was supposed to go 2 years ago, but the pandemic messed things up, and I'm going this January for 35 days.
Oh, wow.
So I will be there for a very long time.
Wow.
Yes,
that is,
I will
so
come
amazing.
Face to face
and
with my.
You'll cope with the passage.
How could I? No, that's the hard part. But I'm doing all of this for the chance to see Scott's hut.
Wow. Okay.
That's
who are you going with?
One of the people.
Okay.
Know, it's like a sailing that only happens twice a year, because it does this particular journey.
Oh my goodness!
But this is my obsession with Robert Scott is so profound that I'm going for the chance that the weather will be okay and I'll get to stand in his hut, which I think my brain will explode.
Wow.
Well, it might freeze.
I will cry.
Your brain might freeze. Well, don't cry.
And the tears will freeze.
Wow. Well, I got to hear your packing list, but that's later.
Ice cream, brain freeze.
Yeah.
So, oh my God.
So I would say for me, reader reaction has had two forms, and they're both perverse. Because people do write to you now, you know?
Yeah.
And it's fantastic, actually, to know a little bit about your readership. And there are two moments in my novel, and one is very early on, and it just involves a tomato. and another later in the book that just involves a face in a stained glass window. And many, many, many people have written me to say that they wept when they got to the tomato scene and when they got to that face in the window. And the reason it's perverse is because they say that they wept, and I'm reading this email going, yes! Yes! Like, they forgot I exist. They forgot it's black marks on a white page. They forget the title of the book. They just know that this man is eating a tomato and weeping, and that his tears are making it salty, and that moves them. And so that kind of response, it just tells you that, you know, what Galway Kinnell said, that this is only half of the transaction. The other half is what happens in the imagination of the reader, right? And it's very much idiosyncratic to each person, what they connect with. And, you know, there's a beautiful woman in this book who I never describe, but everyone agrees that she's beautiful. And I've often thought, like, I'd like to get a room full of people and have them write down the characteristics they think they have, because it's their own notion of beauty, you know, that the reader does that act, and that they let that dream occur. Is actually kind of very intimate. And so the more that I write, the longer I write, the more respectful I am of that privilege, of that intimacy. And so I make sure that that tomato scene has to really work. And I honed and honed and honed that moment. And so when I find that people are moved by it, it means like the illusion has somehow worked, you know? And the other way that it's been great is... and I don't know, it's because my last book came out during COVID and I couldn't tour or what. You can see I kind of tell jokes and stuff. Is that between the jokes and the glass flowers, like the people have been coming out in great numbers, and that's been just like the affirmation of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. I didn't do the launch in a bookstore. I did it in a place, an atelier that makes glass. And it was 1,500 degrees right behind me, but everyone was in comfortable chairs like this. So I'm like pretending I'm not totally sweating through my shirt the whole time, but right, but it was full of people. And and I can't tell you, if you have a couple thousand hours of solitude working with something and putting your whole heart in it, and then you see people show up, everyone in.
Gratitude.
There is such an intimate thing reading a book, and I know that from speaking to so many readers through all these years and having connections to stories and then hearing what their connections are, or the way they maybe pronounce a name, or the way they see something on the page, which is why the discussions are always just so incredible. But the connection of being with readers and getting that back and forth is what it's all about. And I wonder, with 5 minutes, thank you. Doing such a good job, Lindsay. What you like to stretch with the next book? Like, what are some things that in your next books that you can talk about them or not? But like, you know, pieces of yourself that you like to stretch.
Well, I have a book coming out this April that is completely different from anything I've ever written, and I still talk about it as my strange little book. Like, I don't know where this book came from. It's Omniscient Point of View. It's about the apocalypse, like in religious terms. I'm not a religious person, but it's it speaks to, I'm Greek, and so I wrote it during the pandemic when I couldn't travel to Greece the way I regularly do because all my family is there, and it takes place in Athens because I was missing Greece. Mm. And it's about the apocalypse because we were living through a pandemic, and I was very aware that time was running out. Mm. So it's about the end of days. It's called Last Days in Plaka.
Oh, wow, in April?
In April.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's the Irish twin of this one. I mean, it's close.
Yeah, that's,
you
know? Close.
Yeah.
It's a year and a half. Yeah.
So my next one will be out in February of 25. It's called The Finder. And I wanted it to be a very different book than it turned out, which often occurs, I think. And it's about a guy who is flying two young men from New York City to Mount Tremblant, where one of them is having like a bachelor party weekend. And there was no part of me, it's going to sound so stupid, but there was no part of me that thought about the number of times that I took my sons skiing at Tremblant when they were little boys, right? But my sons both live in New York City now, and so they're coming from New York City in this guy's private plane, and guess what? The plane goes down in the Canadian wilderness. And so half of the story is about that sort of survival effort and the person who finds them. And they don't all make it. And so there's a way in which I'm like writing this very blithe little story, and it's not me, and it's not my sons, it's not, okay, it's a little bit like me, okay, but then as well, it's like one of my sons, but like then the subconscious is just like totally taking over the story. And so I get to the end, and it's like, it's not about me. It's just, you know.
Where's my tomato?
And exactly, where is my tomato? These guys, a couple days in the cold, they would love to have a nice frozen tomato. When they survive the plane crash, all they have is those little bags of cocktail peanuts, and that's what they live on for 4 days. Mm. You can get tired of cocktail peanuts pretty fast. But actually, it's a great thing to eat because it's full of fat and protein. I had to learn a lot of the survival stuff. Anyway, there are ways, the characters are totally imagined, and yet the father love for his sons, and they're there for each other. Like, I can't help it.
The heart. Yeah, the heart.
Yeah.
My next book is also historic fiction, also based on a real overlooked woman in history. And without giving away too many details, just because I'm still deep in the process of writing it, but it's set earlier. It's in around the 1815-1617 in Europe, and a woman who was sort of at the center of a very famous group of writers and artists, and really an exploration of sort of, it's one part Jane Austen, and one part an exploration of siblinghood, of what it means to be a sibling, and the sort of loyalty and jealousy that's involved in that relationship, and sort of how we tend to see ourselves as some sort of reflection of our siblings in some way, our definition of ourselves, and then also the men at that time who might have been in the, and then tell me if this is at all relevant, who might have been in very good people politically and maybe complete monsters intrapersonally.
Wow, so. These all sound amazing. Thank you for sharing that, because I know when you're in the middle of it, or you know, depending on where you are, you know how much you can share, but I think that that's what we always want to know. I know it's question time.
Yeah.
Start questions. Thank you.
Yay, Lindsay. Audience
Yay.
Questions.
Hi, everybody.
We can queue up here if you have questions. If not, I will keep going. Is that a question coming? Okay, I wasn't sure. I know people are rushing to other sessions also, so thank you.
Hi. I love historical fiction, always have. So if, could you guys talk about how you do the balance of the historical and the fiction?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question.
For me, I tried to stay very true. This is obviously a real person, so I wanted to honor the fact that this was a real person and really tried to adhere to the backbone of her life and all of the historical figures that she interacted with. But obviously, it's a novel, not a biography. And so the times that I strayed away from pure fact were in service either to the novel or to the character development of Isabella Stewart Gardner. And, you know, if you guys wrote a novel about Isabella Stewart Gardner, it would be a completely different novel. So this is my lens of a clearly sort of early feminist view of her living her life in a quite a loud way. And so much of it is based on truth, and then there are moments, obviously, that I stray from that. And even in stuff that's fact, people that we know that she was really good friends with, for example, Henry James, who was one of her lifelong best friends, we don't have transcripts of their dialogue, so I'm making that up. So, but I was always a very academic, bookish, nerdy kid, and so I love the research. So when there's a street lamp, it's the actual street lamp, and I would never dare introduce the zipper before 1893 at the Chicago World Fair, because that would be really annoying if you knew there were no zippers, and then you saw a zipper, and it were, you know, 1891. So very careful details, but, you know, with a little bit of a novelist freedom.
So E.L. Doctorow said, a historian tells you what happened and a novelist tells you how it felt. Mm. So I've written a series of ones, historical fictions that are risky in what they take on because so many people know every detail. My book, The Baker's Secret, is D-Day told from the French perspective. Actually, that version hasn't been told before. And you know, and there are buffs who know, you know, the invasion was planned in 30-second intervals, and they know the order of those things. So there's a way. It's like writing a sonnet. There is a form to which the novel must obey, right? Must be obedient. But within that, there's still all kinds of room for invention. And in fact, I didn't have the battle of D-Day occur at all. It's much more about what it was like on the farms as this farm was, you know, now in Allied hands, now back in German hands, and so what it was like for those people. And the example I'd like to give of how I snoop, and I worked 20 years or so in newspapers, and so, like, I'm always about, as you say, digging for the fact, because there's choice little things, but they can tell you so much. It's not regular research. So the example I give is The Universe of Two is a love story set amid the development of the atomic bomb. It happens in Los Alamos. So what I can tell you about Los Alamos is it was the largest collection of Nobel Prize winners in one place at one time ever in history, including like when they give out the Nobel, when they give now, there were more people who had Nobels then in chemistry, in metallurgy, in biology, in physics, and so on, right? And all of these great brains, and the milk was always sour. And it would be like there'd be a load of milk that would come up from Santa Fe, and they'd put it right in the fridges there, and in the morning they'd be like, this is going to be such a good cup of coffee, and they'd pour it and be curdled right on top of the glass. So, like, there was a way that, and we all know the experience of, like, seeing curdled
it's
milk
awful.
In our coffee, right? And so it just humanized these people. And so then I found out that they were sleeping under their desks. I had to see the desks they slept under. And they were these little metal desks, you know, and you just picture them like, I know I'm a genius, but can someone put a blanket over me? You know, and it just made it so human. And that's the kind of thing you're kind of, that's what your nose is looking for, is what you're sniffing for, in among all of the times and dates. And, you know, the nice thing about telling D-Day from the French perspective is that person doesn't know, French person doesn't know 82nd Airborne from 101st Airborne. They just know it's somebody with a parachute who's on their side. Mm-hmm. right? And so I can really get to the emotional part of it. But the facts have got to be there, and so you have to nerd out. Yeah, I bet all of us, and we've got acknowledgments in the back that's like, here are the books I read, and the people I interviewed, and the experts, and it's actually part of the fun.
Yeah. I think for me, because I was doing that approach where I'd grown up dipping into the narratives of Antarctica, and I had that sort of embargo for myself, there were other kinds of research that I was doing, like research into photographic processes, because two of the main characters are photographers, and they're working with glass plate negatives, and so I needed to find out, how is this done, and what are the timings, and how do you set the aperture, and I know about developing photographs in a darkroom, but with film. Research into the suffrage movement, and particularly the hunger strikers, who Viola, one of my main characters, becomes involved with. And that was the kind of thing that, yes, I was sort of digging into. But I also knew from the very beginning of writing what is still essentially the first page, that I wanted to strike a tone where, I mean, there are historical novels and historical novels. And as you said, Emily, you know, we would write each other's stories very differently because of how, not only the lens through which we saw the material, but the way we wanted to render the material. How much information am I going to say about the street lamp? Yes. You might say specifically all its qualities, and I might say, yeah, it's a street lamp. and not because I might not know what kind of street lamp, but I might not wish to put that detail in. And it's just how you choose what the rules of your novel are. And I knew from the start that I wanted to write a historical novel that didn't feel, that wasn't burdened by a lot of detail. I wanted to know the detail, but I wasn't necessarily going to put it in. So, you know, there may be details of like what a fabric is and how the dogs are attached to the sledges, but then I use the word sledge because that was the British word, not sled, so that's a bit of historical accuracy.
We talked about that at our event, which was, I think, one of the things that you do so well and that you try to do in historic fiction is it's, you don't want to see the strings moving. You don't want to see the machinations.
Right.
It should feel like a well-lived society, well-lived room, and feel so natural that even if there are tons of details, it's not like a pamphlet that you're reading about how furniture looked in 1861. It should
really just
piece
of it. I mean, there are historical novels that sort of take that moment where they stop, and then they might explain, let me tell you how a bed was constructed in 1872, and that's a different kind of book.
Right.
It's not wrong or right, it's just a different kind of book that approaches it that way.
Yeah, and when you were talking about the photography, one of the things that was so interesting with your book is altering images back in that day. I thought it was a Kardashian Instagram thing.
Yeah,
I was like,
I mean, in fact,
did not know that. I think that's what books do too. You want to, the reader digs into it even more. But
yeah,
anyway,
I mean, there was a lot of altering of images.
I didn't know that.
Even a little bit more than I suggest is true. I mean, it was a thing that Victorians used to do. They would do these sort of artsy double exposures. There was a very big fad of photographing yourself with, or having yourself photographed with, the ghost of your loved one kind of visible as the spirit over your shoulder. And they would do this with, you know, double exposure and other techniques. So let's just say altered photography plays a role in, plays a role in Terra Nova. And I was trying, it's gone. There it
is. We can hear you.
Yeah. I was playing with sort of current day problems with authenticity and accuracy and casting it in that sort of 1910 context.
So, yeah, that's one of the things about historical fiction, about how present it is, you know, and how meaningful the how connected it is as many years as ago as we're talking. You know, Stevens is the most current after World War II, right?
Those were real old.
Right, but the
years.
Goal is to make it
so
feel
present.
Like so present and not feel like you're looking at a sepia photograph from long ago.
But that's the thing.
Just to feel like it's really immediate and that you're there.
You're in the present
the
scene, which is so cool.
I'm still stuck on that street light. I'll tell you why, because the streetlight might give off a scent, or if it's gas, or it might flicker, it might be on and off, and so to me it's more like if there's something dynamic, I mean, you definitely don't want to have the wrong thing, the zipper in 1890, right? You don't want to have that, but But if it's part of the atmosphere you create, you want to make sure that you can do that. In Universal 2, the guy who built it's about the guy who built the detonator for the Nagasaki bomb and had a lot on his conscience after the war because his invention worked. And so he went to Stanford to get a PhD in physics, and he lasted 6 weeks. That's all because everyone was talking about bigger bombs and the H-bomb, and that's where he couldn't deal. So he quit, and he took a part-time job working for a company that repaired church organs. And when he died in 1984, he was considered one of the great cathedral organ builders of all time. And in fact, his company is still up in Gloucester building world-class organs. If you want one, I think they started about $5 million. But I know the Harvard Chapel has one, and they also have the French one that was there before. But this guy, he made the best because Harvard needs that, and so they need the two organs. But it's like I needed to know so much about organs, and organists are a funky crowd of people, and so I'm inside the guts of these organs. Turns out there isn't really volume control in organs. The note is the same volume, but they're these baffles, and they're like thick carpet like this, and they're almost like Phoenician blinds, but vertically, and they're always the same volume. And when they want to be louder, they step on a pedal, and it turns them sideways, so air goes through, and then there's no baffle, and that's how it gets louder. Mm-hmm. And the way that the guy showed me was he had me stand in front of the baffle and go like, "See what you think," and then wham, and just knocked me over. It was so loud. Right? And so you have to know that. I think you have to know that. It's partly so you're not wrong that he's stepping on the volume pedal and it's a baffle pedal, but also because you have an understanding of like what it means for the musician to turn the horsepower on, you know?
Well, it's because you're creating a dream for the reader, and the zipper in the wrong year is going to break that dream. It's going to wake you up. But also, in order to create the dream for the reader, you have to be able to step into the dream yourself, right? And I think that's, we do all the research, we know all the things, so that then we can let them go. And like, at least this is how I feel, like I can let them go and then be like, I'm there. What am I thinking and feeling
and
seeing?
Enough to now
it's like a bit of
scene,
method
right?
acting. Mm-hmm. Like you set everything up so that then you can inhabit it as the writer and then evoke it for the reader to sort of share that same dream with the same level of accuracy. Not accuracy, not meaning that, again, not the zipper in the wrong year, but that sort of authenticity that you want to create. That doesn't have to be grounded in specific details that are on the page. But you just have to be in your head in some way.
So but as you say about breaking the dream, because I've been in that position when I've been reading like an early copy, and I'm like, there's not a law school at Brown. Like, fix this. You know, and I always wonder how much the editors want to know, because I do get them early, and sometimes they're a manuscript, and I am or that kind of reader. And so that does break the dream, even though Brown
and
could
sadly,
have one,
I mean,
they just
it makes
don't.
It makes you question.
Yes.
It, sometimes it shouldn't, but it does make you question the author's authority.
Right.
And sometimes it's all it is one little mistake, and we all make them. But it's like you don't want that. You want to have that empathic shared dream.
Yeah. It just it is magical. Stephen, I'm sorry. What were you
saying? I just thought it was an incredibly one question, and look at us go.
Yeah. I know.
And I did see there's like other people with hands.
Is there someone? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah,
go
yeah.
ahead.
Yeah.
And they were saying it's always awkward to like break it, stop, and go, or like say, please come up. But I'm glad you're here.
So, Stephen, you mentioned that your next book has not gone where you thought it was going to go. How hard do you push against the original idea, and when do you know to let that go and to go with your instinct and where the book is taking you?
Mm. Oh, a process question. Thank you.
I love that.
Okay, here's the truth of it. Because I worked in news for so long, I bang out first drafts, and I pound them out. Like, I wear off the keys. Many of my keys on my computer are blank because I just pound them. Right? Because I'm just accustomed to doing that every day, right? And what I do is, the whole time I have like a roadmap, and there are things that happen that I don't expect, and characters that, if they're going to be consistent with who they are, I need to change plans, and that's where all of that goes on. And the whole time, my conscious mind is working really hard. It's saying it's this time of day, this is how they're dressed, maybe they're hungry, this is the dynamics of these characters, this is what they all want, all of that stuff is going on. Conscious mind, conscious mind, conscious mind. And I get to the end of the first draft, and I know that, and I've learned this from myself, and I didn't know it for several books, that my subconscious is working every bit as hard all the way through, and that it is smarter and more creative and has better facility with language and is better at metaphor. And so what happens is I get to the end of the first draft and I go, okay, what is this book about? And then I say, oh, You know, the curiosity I thought was about this guy running for president, it's actually a love story. And when that final book came out, the guy running for president never appears. Because I go back and it's like the second time is joy. Now I know the story. And his name is Don Hewitt's Dixon, for reasons that if you know the character makes sense. And so he's Dixon. Well, I changed about halfway through. Don Hewitt became Dixon. I didn't even bother fixing it. And now I know his name and what he's like all the way through. And that's when it begins to make sense to me. And then I don't feel like actually I'm giving up something or I'm throwing away something. I feel much more like I'm just accepting the story that is there and then seeing what can I do to deepen it. And often the clues are right there. You know, Jung said, you know, don't worry about the rabbit being in the hat. Your subconscious put it there a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so I find, like, if that puts me in a problem, I go, well, what have I got? Well, these characters, oh, that guy was carrying a knife. And, you know, I found a knife, you know, right when I needed it in The Baker's Secret. I'd forgotten a long time before that he had a knife. And so it's much more like, for me, get it out and then with great detachment go, what's the actual story? And then the second draft for me is like the most fun of the whole thing.
So you can't get too attached to the first draft, is that it?
Yeah, that's another question. I don't. Yeah.
Hey, everyone.
Hey.
Real quick. When you finish your book, you've typed the last word, you've hit the period, you've hit send to your publisher. What do you do next?
They post it on Instagram.
I'm not on
most
Instagram, so
Emily is not.
Next step
most of them do. They go.
Within 30 minutes, are you calling loved ones? Are you grabbing a glass of champagne? How are you celebrating this victory of finishing your
great novel? Question.
That is a great question. I go take a walk. I've got 4 kids and 2 dogs, and I go do stuff. I'm like, oh, I gotta take care of the plants, and I gotta, you know, bake something for, you know, my dad. I go back into my life, and it's a joyful unburdening. It's out in the world, and then I usually call my best friend, who's also a writer, and then we just describe what we're cooking, like what we want to eat.
That's a great question.
I think it depends on the time of day. If it's morning, I'm gonna have a scone. Aww. I'm gonna go and get myself a scone, and I'll go like do some sort of sports thing. That will come for sure. I do have this little glass jar that I think my daughter gave me for Christmas, where after some good publishing milestones, which might have been like I'm done and I know actually it's not gonna come back to me. The boomerang novel, that I started putting champagne corks in it. Mm. And so now it's the jar where the celebratory writing-related champagne corks go, because my husband can be counted on to produce the champagne from somewhere at the right moment. And aww. We actually have this row of, we have these flutes that are like beakers. They're very tall and thin, and they're a bear to clean. And I'm not embarrassed to say, I'm going to say this in public, we have like 6 of them on the windowsill in the kitchen because no one wants to clean them. And they've been there like, celebrations times that's, 2. They're just there, months.
That is so
It's like a college kid who stacks the beer cans.
No, I remember the ramen noodles sitting in the mugs doing. For a long time, yeah.
Let's see, I guess in terms of technically what usually the last thing I do is the last change that I make to the text is inconsequential. It's like I forgot that there's a ladder here. Hmm. No, some people need to not bang into the ladder. The ladder's the last thing I do because I just have a punch list. My brain can't hold the whole book. I wish it could, but it can't. And so I have notes all around me all the time. And if I had my briefcase with me, I'd show you like my notes. And they're insanity, but they all make a sense. And so the last thing I do is like, it's incidental. It's not the last sentence of the book. It's a detail in the middle of the book that needed to be fixed. And then, you know, if you read a book that really works for you, and as you're, and it really has come alive in your imagination, you're actually living with these people, and you get close to the end, you begin to feel that emotion that's building, and you get to the end, and there is that excellent, magnificent, sweet melancholy for which there isn't a word. Mm. That's what I feel when I finish a book. And so usually the first thing I do is weep. And then I go get something really, really, really sugary. And there's a place just down the road from where I live. You know, I'm in a rural part of Vermont, and so the soft ice cream there they call Creamies, but this place is called Cookie Love, because first it was a cookie business, so you can get a creamy that they will roll, instead of in Jimmy's, they roll it in crushed up cookie. And it's like, it's about 1,800 calories for a small. and so I have myself a good cry, and then I go have a Cookie Love if the time of day allows. And I'm pretty much stoned on sugar for the next couple of hours, and then I take a nap. Because I crash from it. And I feel like this is a good, no animals are harmed in the making of this. Yeah, it feels big, and the main reason it feels big is because for all this time it's been mine. And when I hit send, it ceases to be mine. And it only goes further and further away from you, because it's your editor, and then it's publicity and marketing, and then it's reviewers, and then it's the people you see on tour, and the readers take possession of it, and ultimately it was only yours temporarily.
Wow, what a great way to end. And I hate to end, but we got the time sign, so I want to just thank everybody and Boston Book Festival for hosting us. Books are for sale. Our amazing authors will be over here, and it's not too early to start shopping for the holidays, and signed books make the best gifts, and these are three winners. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Lindsay.
I regret there was no good opportunity.